Well, good evening, Little Masters, and welcome to episode 209 of the Prancing Pony Podcast, where, when dawn comes, we will bid men sound Helm's horn.
I doubt we'll cleave a road, but we might make such an end as will be worth a song.
Maybe.
Now, folks, go ahead and pull up a bench in the common room. I'm Sean Marchese, the real-life Lord of the Mark, and I'm here with the Man of the West, who looked out to see the dawn, Alan Sisto.
Well, after all, none know what the new day shall bring him.
Indeed.
Of course, the odds of me actually getting up to look out and see the dawn are pretty slim, let's just be honest.
Probably greater than me getting up to see the dawn.
Fair enough. Well, folks, today we are going to be talking about the third and last part of Helm's Deep. Now, that's Chapter 7 in Book 3 of The Lord of the Rings. And frankly, it's when Saruman's army finds out the hard way what a terrible general he is.
And we're going to make sure he knows it, too.
Yes, we will.
Now, for those of you joining us for the first time, welcome. Here at the Prancing Pony Podcast, we are working our way through J.R.R. Tolkien's Legendarium a few pages at a time.
We study the details, make connections to other writings, talk about our favorite themes.
And we have a lot of fun along the way. So we're glad you've joined us.
And we hope you'll be glad you joined as well.
Indeed we do. But before we get back to the text, it is time for a visit to the North Wing.
Well, today we're bringing you another new installment of the North Wing.
Barlam and Butterbur had a room or two in the North Wing at the Prancing Pony Inn, made special for hobbits. Well, this is our place, made special for some of our listeners, to give us a chance to get to know them.
Now, rooms at the North Wing are a little hard to come by these days, so only our patrons at the Bombadil's Bequest and Círdan's Contribution tiers are eligible. If you'd like to be one of the next patrons to join us, be sure to check out patreon.com/prancingponypod.
Please do. We've got a waiting list for the North Wing right now, but we'll get to all of them soon, and we'll make room for more if necessary.
We will. Well, with that done, why don't we go ahead and welcome tonight's guest to the North Wing, Jeff Perks.
Hello. How you guys doing?
We're doing all right, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Pleasure to have you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Great. Well, go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? What do you do? And what do your loved ones think of all this Tolkien stuff you're into? Do they think you're a total nerd? Do they like it too? You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I currently live in Fort Worth, Texas.
Okay.
All right. Texas in the house.
I'm originally from way out east, so I'm from Boston, Mass. Originally, I'm a teacher. I teach high school, teach world history.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Which explains why you have so much patience.
I'm not in charge right now. Yeah. So it's easy.
For those of you who, of course, were not in the booth during the lead
which is
to
all
this,
of them,
which is everybody. Sean and I had some technical problems with Zencaster, and Jeff's been patient for probably 20 minutes before we could even get to this. So. Only a teacher. Thank you.
Yeah. Yep. But as far as what my family and friends think about the Tolkien stuff, my family for a while thought it was kind of nerdy and weird, but they've grown to accept that it's not going away.
Good.
Yeah. They kind of wish that other interest went away. You know, I'm still like in the pro wrestling, but they haven't quite accepted that part of me, but they're okay with the Lord of the Rings stuff. And then my fiance just finished Return of the King not too long ago, a couple months ago now.
Awesome.
Yes.
Right on.
So she's accepted it at least.
Good. Good. Yeah. But has she accepted the pro wrestling?
She pretends to.
Good enough.
Hey, that's a start, right?
I'll take that. Yeah.
You know, Sean, I think we just developed a strategy for people who are having problems with people in their lives accepting Tolkien. Have an interest that is less acceptable.
Exactly.
And therefore, interest in Tolkien seems a whole lot more okay.
It's like, hey, at least it's not such and such.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know.
That's right.
All right.
And I'm sitting here thinking, man, I need to get back into pro wrestling.
So. It's a lot of fun. Yeah.
You know, my kids are just getting to that age where I'm thinking like, yeah, I think it's about time to introduce my son to pro wrestling.
Oh, that is hilarious.
He's right at that age where it's like, you know, I mean, for normal people, Jeff, there's a few years where you're into it and then you get over it. But
did you just call our guest abnormal, Sean? Wow.
No, maybe a little, but in the best way. Because I'm envious because I kind of miss pro wrestling myself.
Yeah, you wouldn't be wrong to call me abnormal, so it's all right.
All right.
I do miss Sergeant Slaughter in the Iron Sheik. That's true.
See, I've watched a little bit more recently. I'm, you know, my last time was like, you know, The Rock and Triple H and all those guys.
There you go. Yeah.
That was another golden age. Anyway, we digress.
Yeah.
But anyway, well, Jeff, the question we ask everyone who comes to the Prancing Pony, when and how did you first discover Tolkien's works? What was your experience like and why do you keep coming back?
So I was first introduced to it, I think I was in the fourth or fifth grade. My older sister had to read The Hobbit for school and didn't want to. And so she gave it to me and told me to read it and tell her what happens. And so that was kind of the first time I read The Hobbit, which coincided pretty well with right around the release of the first Lord of the Rings movie.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So that, yeah, that went together very nicely. But what keeps me coming back is I read it just about every year. I read Lord of the Rings just about every year. And
yeah,
I feel like as I've gotten older, it's kind of grown with me, and I've been able to appreciate it in different ways. When I was young, you know, elves, dwarves, orcs, battles, awesome.
Right.
And now that I'm a little older and I can look at it through the lens of my faith tradition and things like that, it's been a very cool experience.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite things about it, is just every time I read it, I feel like, now that I don't have time to read it all the way through, you know, more often than once every couple of years. And I feel like I'm a different person every time now.
Yeah.
And it does totally grow with you. That's cool.
It absolutely does. Well, which is your favorite book in the Legendarium and why? And then if you have a favorite non-Legendarium book, go ahead and let us know what that is and why.
Yeah. I think my favorite is probably, right now, is probably Fellowship of the Ring.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I think, especially during pandemic times, kind of a more idyllic Shire, you know, it's a good little escape.
Absolutely.
I think my favorite non-Legendarium is the Beowulf translation.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's a good call. Mm-hmm.
I did not read all the books I was supposed to in high school, but I did read Beowulf, so that might be the reason. Yeah.
That's a good reason.
Very cool. Yeah, no, that's a really good one. We don't get that answer a lot, do we, Alan? I feel like
that might be the very first Beowulf. I mean, I know that in a recent episode, one of our guests talked about Beowulf being her favorite, but it wasn't a North Wing segment.
Right.
So this might be the first North Wing guest who said Beowulf.
I'm sure less than three people, if any, have answered that. That's awesome.
That is great.
Well, Jeff, do you have a favorite memory of a Tolkien-related activity? Maybe some time you spent with family or friends in a Tolkien-y kind of way, maybe like a special vacation or reading books to kids, something like that?
Not particularly. Tolkien, and this was always kind of my realm, and I was left to my own devices with it. But I think recently with my fiance reading it and being able to kind of experience that along with her as she's reading for the first time was awesome.
Isn't that amazing, being able to enjoy somebody's first read through?
Yeah, and having a hard time keeping my mouth shut and not.
Wait till you see what happens.
Cry.
Yeah,
don't cry. Right. He'll live.
Or diving into like way too much detail explaining.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, let me explain about the Seven Sons of Feanor.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Way too much information.
Yeah. Galadriel's gift to Gimli is really cool because I don't.
That's right.
Care. I'm like, okay.
Don't care. That's awesome.
That's great.
Well, we're going to go ahead and enter into our lightning round. These are quick questions and answers. Well, quick questions and hopefully quick answers, but that's up to you. What is your favorite scene or moment in The Lord of the Rings?
Probably the Bridge of Khazad Dûm with the Balrog. Oh,
yes.
All right. That's
wait,
a good one.
Wait. Now we have to ask another question, Sean.
That's actually a perfect segue into the next question I was going to ask. And Jeff, this one is for everything. Balrog wings, actual or metaphorical?
Metaphorical.
Yay.
You passed the test.
But then you can believe them into existence. If you believe hard enough.
Fair enough.
All right.
I believe.
Yeah.
A wish for wings that work.
There you go. All right. Well, do you consider yourself a Merry or a Pippin?
A Merry.
All right. What do you think happened to the Antwives?
Unfortunately, I think they are all gone.
Yeah,
probably so.
Who's your favorite author or what's your favorite book outside of Tolkien?
I think probably just because I'm reading it right now, but I'm reading Tom Shippey's Laughing Shall I Die, and I've been really, really enjoying that.
That is a great book, isn't it?
Yeah, that was awesome. Man.
And a great chat with Tom, too. That was fun. Well, those were some great answers, Jeff. Thank you so much for joining us. We have really enjoyed having you here in the North Wing.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Folks, it's time for us all to head back to the common room and join the rest of the listeners.
Indeed. Thanks again, Jeff. But hopefully we'll see you back here sometime, maybe at a Questions After Nightfall or some other time.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And now, folks, we return you to the podcast in progress. It is always a real treat getting to visit with our listeners like that. So thanks again, Jeff. And folks, we hope to be talking to more of you soon. But for now, let's get back to the text. Sean, let me have you pick up exactly where we left off last episode.
All right. Even as they spoke, there came a blare of trumpets. Then there was a crash and a flash of flame and smoke. The waters of the deeping stream poured out hissing and foaming. They were choked no longer. A gaping hole was blasted in the wall. A host of dark shapes poured in.
"Devilry of Saruman!" cried Aragorn. "They have crept in the culvert again while we talked, and they have lit the fire of Orthanc beneath our feet. Elendil! Elendil!" he shouted, as he leaped down into the breach. But even as he did so, 100 ladders were raised against the battlements. Over the wall and under the wall, the last assault came sweeping like a dark wave upon a hill of sand. The defense was swept away.
Bad news.
And why'd I have to start with that one? Oh, I'm depressed already.
Well, you know, sometimes that's just the way the chapters are written. I guess you have to talk to Tolkien about that.
Yeah, it's always darkest before the something.
The dawn?
Something like that.
I think so. Well, folks, the action picks right back up with more trumpets, and now we get the flame and the smoke. And the first real sign of what happened is the deeping stream hissing and foaming.
Yeah, and then to really start telling you what's happening, the enemy starts pouring through this hole that they've just made.
That would be the point, yeah.
That would be the point. And Aragorn cries out, "Devilry of Saruman!"
Indeed. I mean, he's rightly observing, by the way, after that they did all this while they were talking.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, he makes his famous Elendil shout before leaping into the fray like Aragorn does.
Yes, absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit about this devilry, shall we? Remember, all the way back in episode 159, we saw this word devilry used. And remember, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, devilry simply means a wicked act or an instance of evil doing or cruelty or reckless mischief.
Right.
Back in episode 159, it meant not the Balrog, you know, like not the actual demonic presence. Don't be fooled into thinking that's what it means.
Right.
But what it meant was the orcs' attempt to trap the fellowship with fire.
That's right. And here Tolkien uses devilry to mean another kind of fire, which honestly may not be a coincidence.
It might not. I mean, certainly here, where this is obviously some sort of explosive, which is a kind of mischief because it's not something that's common in this world, right? Not everybody has this technology. Yeah, maybe that is exactly what he's trying to do with this by using this word again here. But let's talk about the explosive. It's most likely black powder.
Yeah.
The film certainly portrays it as black powder. I remember it being those coarse grains of black powder in the movie.
Right. Yeah, not gunpowder. And we'll talk about that in a little bit, the difference between the two. But black powder. I think they call it corned black powder, I think.
I think that was it, yeah.
Yeah. Brett talks about that on his blog, but we'll get to that. Here, of course, we get in the book the crash and a flash of flame and smoke. And one of the things that makes black powder different from gunpowder is the amount of smoke that it lets off. So that is what makes me think this is black powder.
Right.
Aragorn mentions it to Theoden again later, using the term again, devilry, and then calls it a blasting fire, which again, sounds like black powder to me.
Yeah. And we'll see it again in this chapter later, as apparently the enemy do have lots of charges here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Remember before Aragorn's parley, which we remember because we just read the chapter in preparation for this episode.
That's right.
We'll get to it soon. We read that blasts of fire leaped up from below, shaking the stones.
Saruman's a very inventive fellow when it comes to this sort of thing. He not only has plenty of something very much like black powder, but he also has something very much like napalm, which he thankfully didn't bring with him here.
That's right. Either napalm or the other thing that I think of.
Oh, yeah.
That we're about to talk about is Greek fire.
Greek fire, right.
Which is basically analogous to napalm, but much
yeah,
more
same
ancient.
Concept, just less technologically advanced.
Right. In a couple of chapters, we're going to read Pippin's account of the attack on Isengard, and he's going to mention poor Beachbone the Ent, who got caught in a spray of some liquid fire and burned like a torch. A horrible sight.
Oh, goodness, that is a terrible thing. And it is a good thing he didn't bring that here, but maybe it was still under development or just not safely portable. I mean, granted, Saruman doesn't have very high safety standards. I'm thinking that the sign that says days since workplace deaths probably never hit double digits.
Probably not. I'm not sure he's got any number except one. And the one is lost.
We've gone one day since a workplace death when somebody throws somebody off a railing.
Right. Well, Brett Devereaux, who has been sort of our companion during these episodes.
Willing or no.
we've dragged him along with us. He's got some things to say about this, as he compares it to the visual that we all remember from the film, of course.
Yeah.
He points out that the biggest difference between the film and the books when it comes to the black powder is the timing of the attack.
Yeah, yeah.
He points out that the blast, and I'm quoting from him here, occurs as a clear reaction to the repeated failure to take the fortress with more conventional tactics.
Right.
Charitably, I think we might assume that Saruman had provisioned his troops with the blasting fire in the expectation that it would be necessary to clear the caves, but that in desperation, they first used some of these charges to clear the wall.
Okay.
I mean, that makes sense. Obviously, they couldn't get through the wall, and the only alternative was to go back to Saruman and say, boss, we couldn't get in. Sorry.
That's a bad idea.
I don't think he's going to take that well.
No, no. And Brett also believes that this wasn't part of the original plan. Again, in the books. We're talking about the books version.
Right.
That quote there was describing how it's in the books. It's a clear reaction to this repeated failure as opposed to this big central part of his strategy or part of the tactics, I should say.
Right, where we see Saruman and Wormtongue talking about it ahead of time and, oh, we're going to use this to take down.
Right, and you have the elite troops and this special attempt. I mean, you know, that was all almost like a distraction so they could then bring the guys against the wall here. But in the books, this wasn't part of the original plan. It was, as Brett puts it, a reaction to a setback rather than a clearly planned part of the assault. After all, they'd already gotten through the culvert secretly. The problem was they attacked too early and were beaten, and the culvert got sealed. And this, well, once again, Brett points out, this shows up Saruman's ineptitude.
Yeah.
Only this charge did anything useful.
Right.
All the other charges were ineffective against the Hornburg itself, and they obviously never sealed the tunnels with them. So, like he concludes, evidently these charges were not fit for the task, at least in the time they were given.
Right. Now, in talking about the concept of the attack in the first place, something that applies to both the book and the film version, Brett points out some terrible strategy on the part of Saruman if this was indeed his plan.
That's right. I mean, film Saruman says it very clearly, doesn't he? If the wall is breached, Helm's Deep will fall.
Oh, who can forget that? Yeah.
Which doesn't actually make any sense at all.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, it really doesn't.
It's very well said by Christopher Lee. But
yeah. It's a great line, but it's totally inaccurate because, well, first of all, the wall clearly got breached, but the fortress remained untaken.
Right.
But Brett points out, really, Saruman's stated tactical plan for the attack is exactly backwards. He points out that the fortress looms over the wall itself, and it is a far more formidable structure. If you take the fortress, you can then rain down missile fire on the defenders that are still on the wall. But if you blow the wall, as Brett says, it ensures that more of the defenders will be crammed within the Hornburg, making the capture of the one place on the field that matters more difficult.
In other words, maybe they should have saved their black powder and used it at the gates of the Hornburg.
Maybe.
Although it probably would have been harder to direct the force properly.
Because that's fair. Yeah.
Think about the fact that using the culvert did allow for much of the energy to be focused and therefore destructive, kind of like a big gun barrel, really.
True, true.
But weaken the gates with this and then attack with the rams?
Yeah.
Then you take the fortress and the wall itself becomes pretty much irrelevant.
Pretty much does. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, imagine yourself on the wall and you're looking up at the fortress and all you see now are orcs with their arrows, you know, orcs
above
with their bows.
You. Yeah.
Above you with rocks and with, I mean, they now have the defensive advantage.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Got to take the Hornburg.
Saruman, not a good general.
No.
All right. Well, let's get back to the text here. So at the same time as this is going off and Aragorn is jumping down to fight, we get 100 ladders being raised against the battlements. Now, before we were told there were hundreds, plural, multiple hundreds. Here we're told 100. Now, I don't know if this is just 100 of the total that they have or.
That's true. It's 100 more. I mean, they'd already cast down some of the other ones.
Yeah, it could
ones,
be.
Right?
Yeah, that could be. Yeah, 100 new ones.
So it's at least it's 100 more.
Yeah.
And now, though, we get this simultaneous over-under, and now the assault finally succeeds. I mean, the defense is swept away.
Yeah, exactly. So the riders are forced back into the deep. This is after the part that I read.
Right.
Back into the deep towards the caves or up towards the citadel.
But, you know, the thing is, it was the wall attack that really drove this to work. Because now you've got them in the deep, you're having to pull defenders off of the wall, and that's when a ladder attack can work. Because it's worth reminding you that ladder assaults usually fail. We talked about this last week. And Devereux repeats himself on this, but that means we will too. He points out that Saruman's failure to bring any actual siege engines really heightens the contrast between the Witch King's towers and catapults professional preparation and Saruman's ladders and bows amateur hour assault. Again, Brett's saying, I think this is an intended element of the story, contrasting the real strength of Sauron with Saruman's dilettantish incompetence and baseless pride. Not an error on Tolkien's part. And I got to say, I'm waiting for a way to fit dilettantish incompetence into a sentence.
It's like Saruman read like Generaling for Dummies and then seriously thought that he could just go up against the Rohirrim or anybody, really.
Anyone. Yeah.
Yeah.
He really does take the approach that quantity has a quality all its own, which it does.
But yeah. But there are lots of other things that count in a battle.
Yeah, there are a lot. And yeah, we'll see several more. We're only just beginning, let's be honest.
Yeah. Well, why don't we go ahead and continue with the readings? And you're going to pick up right where I not left off reading, but right where the Rohirrim are going back towards the Citadel.
Okay. A broad stairway climbed from the deep up to the rock and the rear gate of the Hornburg. Near the bottom stood Aragorn. In his hand still, Anduril gleamed, and the terror of the sword for a while held back the enemy, as, one by one, all who could gain the stair passed up towards the gate. Behind on the upper steps knelt Legolas. His bow was bent, but one gleaned arrow was all that he had left, and he peered out now, ready to shoot the first orc that should dare to approach the stair. "All who can have now got safe within, Aragorn," he called. "Come back." Aragorn turned and sped up the stair, but as he ran, he stumbled in his weariness. At once his enemies leapt forward. Up came the orcs, yelling, with their long arms stretched out to seize him. The foremost fell, with Legolas' last arrow in his throat, but the rest sprang over him. Then a great boulder, cast from the outer wall above, crashed down upon the stair and hurled them back into the deep. Aragorn gained the door, and swiftly it clanged to behind him. "Things go ill, my friends," he said, wiping the sweat from his brow with his arm. "Ill enough," said Legolas, "but not yet hopeless while we have you with us. Where is Gimli?" "I do not know," said Aragorn. "I last saw him fighting on the ground behind the wall, but the enemy swept us apart."
"Alas, that is evil news," said Legolas.
Though I think it's only evil news because he doesn't get to brag.
We'll get there in a minute.
We'll get there. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. All right.
Well, all right. So there's the stairway that's climbing up to the back of the Hornburg.
Which is not climbing to heaven, by the way. This is not.
No, it's not. And there's not a lady who's sure all the glitters is gold.
No. But boy, that's perfectly fit with Aragorn on the stairs.
Exactly. The guy who's defending it is gold, but does not glitter.
Right.
So yeah, Aragorn is defending this and Legolas.
Yeah.
But the text tells us that the terror of the sword
is
holding back the foe as Aragorn's kind of fighting this rearguard action.
Oh, I love that. I absolutely love that. And he's covered by Legolas, who only has one arrow, but, you know, they don't know that necessarily.
Right. The terror of the one arrow. He's just
the terror of the arrow.
Poking them in the eyes.
The lone arrow.
Pulling it back. But then once all is safe in the Hornburg, Aragorn begins to retreat.
Yeah.
But the orcs chase after him. And this is really scary because he actually stumbles in his weariness.
Oh, he's exhausted.
He's tired, man. He's exhausted.
He's been fighting nonstop for hours at this point, right?
And this reminds me of Éomer stumbling and tripping in the previous episode,
right? And Gimli saved him. And here,
right.
Well, here Legolas doesn't actually save him. It's the boulder that saves him. That's a nice boulder. I like that boulder.
That's a nice boulder.
But, you know, Legolas does do the shoot through the throat thing because he is really good.
Yeah.
I like that.
He is really good. He's one of the best, they say. Mm-hmm. So Aragorn gets inside, says things
Wait,
go
question.
Ill.
Is this a spiritual boulder? With apologies to Corey Olson and the Tolkien Professor crew. I just had to say that.
Oh, man. Spiritual boulder. That's right. I love it.
Oh, goodness. Sorry. All right. Continue. All right. Good, sir.
So Aragorn gets inside and says, look, things go ill, my friends. Interesting that he says my friends, plural.
Yeah.
Kind of seems like he's talking only to Legolas. I mean, I can see him sort of taking in the room when he says it, and maybe Legolas is the only one who responds.
That's probably, yeah.
But I don't know. It is kind of weird where he says, my friends, and it's like, there's only one friend here. But
yeah, Legolas, I don't see anybody else, man.
I know there are others here.
There really have to be. I'm sure he's coming back in. That room is not going to be defended only by Legolas at this
point. By Legolas, good of an archer as he is.
With one arrow. He stands really, really close to the door.
One terrifying arrow.
Shoot somebody, pulls the arrow out. Shoot somebody, pulls the arrow out. Right. Just keep recycling the thing.
Yeah. Orlando Bloom could do it.
He could. That's true. With CG help, yeah.
With CG help. But then Legolas gives us this great line. Yeah, things are not going great, but it's not yet hopeless.
Oh, yes.
While we have you with us.
That's right. Estelle, yeah.
You. Estelle, of course. And I don't know if that's intentional wordplay. Probably not, but it's pretty cool.
We're the ones who pick on that all the time.
Yeah.
You know, Aragorn, let us have me.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly. It's a joke, but he's right. You know,
anytime Aragorn and Hope appear together, it's
going to happen, folks.
It's going to happen. And I mean, maybe Tolkien is conscious of this.
I wouldn't be surprised. And this wouldn't be a big shock if we're to see this as Legolas saying that we not only have you with us, and that means we're not hopeless, but quite literally, your name is Hope, so we are not hopeless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Tolkien obviously is conscious of this. He knows that Aragorn is a symbol of hope in the story. And so he knows what he's doing here, I think.
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, in a very literal sense, he just means, look, it's not hopeless. We've still got a chance.
We do. We do. And of course, then he asks about Gimli, and Aragorn can only say they were swept apart. And at first, Legolas seems really shaken. Oh, this is evil news. And that's as far as we read.
Yeah, he does. But we quickly find out, two paragraphs down the line,
right,
is that the real reason he wanted to know about Gimli was because he wanted to update him on what his score was.
Yeah, I'm at 39 now, man.
Yeah.
But Aragorn does say something in that passage that we would do well to remember, this part that I didn't read. Gimli's going to be safe in the caves. Not only is he going to be safe, it's going to be to his liking. And we'll see later on that it's really to his liking.
Yeah, that's right. We will see. Those caves do have an effect on him, don't they?
That's right. We're going to see that in a couple of episodes when we do the road to Isengard.
Right.
We're going to see Gimli talk at length about the impact that these caves have on him.
Yeah.
I mean, he won't shut up. He just keeps going.
No, it's going to be nothing but talking about Galadriel and the caves for the rest of the book, pretty much.
Where's the old man?
There needs to be like a meme of like Gimli's brain, and it's a pie chart with like 60% Galadriel, like maybe 20% the caves of Aglarond.
Right.
And then 20%.
Where's the old man? I don't like horses and I'm tired.
Right. All right. Oh man. Somebody needs to make that, please.
I think somebody will now. Yeah.
Make it and send it to us. But, but Aragorn also points out, look, Gimli's not a shabby fighter. I mean, he says,
no,
never did I see an axe so wielded.
Wow. That's high praise.
Aragorn's been in a lot of fights. I'm sure he's seen a lot of guys swing a lot of axes.
Mm-hmm.
Never has he seen anybody wield an axe like this.
Gimli's quite a warrior. No doubt about it. Yeah.
Quite. And then Legolas gives his final line here about, you know, replenishing his arrow and wishing that he had a little bit better light.
I know. Yeah.
Probably to preempt any criticism of having a lower score than Gimli.
Yeah, that's right. If I've missed. Yeah, I didn't hit 100% of my targets.
Yeah, it's like, okay, well, if Mr. Swings an axe so well is going to beat me, well, it's probably because I'm out of arrows and it's really dark.
That's the only reason why.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Would that this night would end, he says. I like that. But would that this night wouldn't end? Because if you're listening to this on the day that it comes out, we are beginning our third and final day of the first ever PPP Digital Moot. We hope that you were able to make it and that you enjoyed Amy Sturgis, Mike Drought, Tom Shippey, and all the other folks who got to share with us.
Not to mention the pub quiz, the pun battles, and the other fun social gatherings. But even if you missed the moot and you missed our Ask Me Anything style live episode recording, be sure to join us next week when that episode airs and you'll get to hear from us just like you were there.
If it was as good as we think it will be, you're going to want to make sure that you come to our next moot, whenever that happens to be.
Please do. And in the meantime, please visit our website, because we've got all the good stuff there. Show notes, outtakes, Prancing Pony ponderings, and our online storefront, where you can get PPP shirts, mugs, stickers, and more.
And one of the best resources we have there is our library. Our web guru, Phil Dean, has worked really hard on redesigning the library this season, and it shows. Now, as you know, we love the books here at the Prancing Pony Podcast, and we want to make sure you can get your hands on any of the books that we mention here.
Yeah, we may talk about a lot of Tolkien-related stuff on the podcast, but at heart, Alan and I are fans of Tolkien's books and books about Tolkien. That's why we have the library page with links to every book we've mentioned on the show.
Now, we do make a few pennies from the purchases you make from those links, and we thank you for your support. Wielding an axe and making your way back to the caves one dead orc at a time, that's hard. Now, lots of things can make your workouts hard, too. Extra resistance, double speed, one more mile. Your socks shouldn't, though. That's why Bombas Performance Socks are built to be nothing but comfortable and supportive.
Bombas Performance Socks have taken all those amazing innovations that make them the comfiest socks around and added their special Hextech performance technology.
Moisture-wicking yarn and temperature-regulating vents allow cool air to flow in and prevent your feet from overheating.
There's a pillow-like tab to keep you from getting blisters, a special arch-hugging system, and really effective stay-up technology.
And the extra layer of cushiony comfort on the bottom gives Bombas Performance Socks the perfect amount of support.
They come in different styles for every sport, with special features designed in to help maximize performance and, as always, keep your feet comfortable.
And like all their socks, for every pair of Bombas Performance Socks you buy, they donate a pair to someone in need. over 45 million pairs so far and still counting.
And I have to tell you, the Bombas Performance running quarter socks are perfect for a Texas summer. Whether I'm walking around the block or in the park or just running around outside after my kids, they keep my feet padded and dry.
Yeah, I love their running socks. And I also use their cycling socks a lot just about every day. And I'm telling you, they stay up, they're perfectly comfortable, and they do the job. They keep my feet comfortable and dry, frankly. I don't get, all hot and sweaty.
Yep.
So go to bombas.com/PPP today and get 20% off your first order.
That's BOMBAS.com. Bombas.com/PPP for 20% off your first purchase. Bombas.com/PPP.
All right, well, let's go ahead and get back to the story. Sean, if you could read about Aragorn getting into the Citadel and meeting up with Théoden. This is a good passage.
All right. Aragorn now passed into the Citadel. There, to his dismay, he learned that Éomer had not reached the Hornburg.
"Nay, he did not come to the rock," said one of the Westfold men. "I last saw him gathering men about him and fighting in the mouth of the deep. Gamling was with him, and the dwarf, but I could not come to them."
Aragorn strode on through the inner court and mounted to a high chamber in the tower. There stood the king, dark against a narrow window, looking out upon the vale.
"What is the news, Aragorn?" he said.
"The Deeping Wall is taken, lord, and all the defense swept away, but many have escaped hither to the rock."
"Is Éomer here?"
"No, lord, but many of your men retreated into the deep, and some say that Éomer was amongst them. In the narrows they may hold back the enemy and come within the caves. What hope they may have then, I do not know."
"More than we. Good provision, it is said, and the air is wholesome there because of the outlets through fissures in the rock far above. None can force an entrance against determined men. They may hold out long."
Well, while Legolas may have been merely disappointed to find that Gimli wasn't with Aragorn, we see here that Aragorn is genuinely dismayed to learn that Éomer did not reach the Hornburg.
Yeah, no, he learns that Éomer was with Gamling and Gimli near the mouth of the caves, just where he suspected Gimli would be, and as we'll see, that gives him some hope.
Yeah, as it would. I mean,
yeah,
that's where you want Gimli to be, is the safest place. So.
Right.
So then Aragorn makes his way into the court, and he finds the king, who's asking for news, and so he tells him, the wall is taken, there's no more defense, but most of the men have made it into the fortress, so that's a start.
Yeah, and others, including Éomer, have retreated into the deep.
Yeah.
Possibly heading for the caves where they might find some hope.
Yeah. And that's when the king points out some good things about that option. You know, there's fresh air because of the fissures, there's food, and it's a really good place to defend.
Right. And then after the end of the passage I read, Aragorn points out to Théoden the devilry from Orthanc, right?
Yeah.
Uses that word again.
Yep.
Talks about they have a blasting fire, they took the wall.
Yep.
And then he expresses some concern that the caves might actually be sealed up.
Yeah. Which very well might have been Saruman's intent, right? I mean, we were talking about, what did they bring the blasting charges for? Yeah.
Right. And then Aragorn points out the obvious. Look, now it's time to think of the defense of the Hornburg. You know, we have to turn all our thought to that.
And the defense of the king, right?
Yeah.
No doubt. Well, that's where I'm going to pick up, because now we get to the second part of this conversation. And again, there's some really powerful moments in this for sure.
Oh, yeah.
"I fret in this prison," said Théoden. "If I could have set a spear in rest, riding before my men upon the field, maybe I could have felt again the joy of battle, and so ended. But I serve little purpose here."
"Here at least you are guarded in the strongest fastness of the mark," said Aragorn. "More hope we have to defend you in the Hornburg than in Edoras, or even at Dunharrow in the mountains."
"It is said that the Hornburg has never fallen to assault," said Théoden. "But now my heart is doubtful. The world changes, and all that once was strong now proves unsure. How shall any tower withstand such numbers and such reckless hate? Had I known that the strength of Isengard was grown so great, maybe I should not so rashly have ridden forth to meet it, for all the arts of Gandalf. His counsel seems not now so good as it did under the morning sun." "Do not judge the counsel of Gandalf until all is over, lord," said Aragorn.
"The end will not be long," said the king. "But I will not end here, taken like an old badger in a trap. Snowmane and Hasufel and the horses of my guard are in the inner court. When dawn comes,
I will bid men sound Helm's horn, and I will ride forth. Will you ride with me then, son of Arathorn? Maybe we shall cleave a road, or make such an end as will be worth a song, if any be left to sing of us hereafter. I will ride with you, said Aragorn. Taking his leave, he returned to the walls and passed round all their circuit, enheartening the men and lending aid wherever the assault was hot.
Oh, that's such a great dialogue.
It
you know,
is.
Honestly, this is the dialogue between Aragorn and Théoden that I wish we would have gotten
yes.
in the movies.
Yeah.
I mean, we do get the delivery of the reckless hate line by Bernard Hill.
Oh, he does a phenomenal job with that.
He does, yeah. And his delivery of that line is fantastic.
Really is.
But this is also around the time when we get that out of the blue line about let this be the hour we draw swords together, which we talked about last time. And how Théoden says it to Aragorn instead of Aragorn to Éomer. We talked about this last time.
Yeah.
Anyway, the rest of this moment is pretty different too, but why don't we go through it first from the text and then we'll talk about it as we go.
Sounds like an idea. Théoden starts first by lamenting his apparent inability to take action, right? He wants to be fighting with his men. He knows he's likely to die, but he wants what's left of his life to serve a purpose, right?
Oh man, he's doing the Beowulf thing here for sure.
He really, really is. There's so much Beowulf in this song.
This is like Beowulf at the end of his life when he knows he's going to die, but he's going to go out and fight the dragon before he does.
Yep. That's right.
And Aragorn points out how they can defend him better here. And let's remember, it is very important to protect the king. Aragorn doesn't say this, but he definitely implies it.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense because Aragorn doesn't even know if Éomer is even alive. So,
wow, so it's the whole line. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, exactly. This could be the line right here.
Yeah. And also remember, though, this was the thing that Aragorn was tasked to do. This is quite literally his job. Gandalf told him, keep well the Lord of the Mark till I return. Await me at Helm's Gate.
Yeah.
So, honestly, I feel like Aragorn here is showing that he's got total confidence that Gandalf's going to return and that all he needs to do is keep playing defense.
That's a good catch. Yeah. He's going to stay at his post.
Yeah.
Gandalf posted him to watch over Théoden, and that's what he's going to do.
Yeah. Meet you at the gate. I'm going to meet you at the gate. Keep well the Lord of the Mark. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. Everyone should keep well the Lord of the Mark. He needs a lot of taking care of, some might
say.
Yeah,
well, you know.
So Théoden here is starting to show a little doubt here. You know, he has this kind of heartbreaking line about it's said that the Hornburg has never fallen. It shouldn't be possible for it to fall.
Right, right.
But look, the world's changing. Everything's different now. I mean, all that once was strong now proves unsure. I mean, this is one of those world in decline moments, you know.
Yeah, it is.
We're just not what we once were, men or not.
No.
And then, of course, the great line about such numbers and such reckless hate.
Yeah.
He's in doubt. He's in a lot of fear here.
Yeah, he is. For good reason. I mean,
yeah,
they just don't stop coming. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to stop, and they're not going to stop coming, meaning there will always be more to take their place, and there's nothing that's going to be said or done that will get them to go away.
Yeah. Boy, that's a Beowulfian thing, isn't it?
Isn't it? Circle of light, and it's getting smaller.
That's right. Absolutely. And then he expresses doubt about Gandalf's counsel. He's like, look, maybe we shouldn't have done this, you know?
This was rash, right? Might have been rash. Gandalf's advice just, honestly, in the light of day, it was a much better piece of advice. Here in the middle of the night, having been fighting since, you know, the sun has gone down, I'm not so sure. Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, well, this is like that hour, right? The hour of the wolf from Babylon 5, right?
Oh, man.
You know? It's that moment. It's just before the dawn, and you're just... Everything seems worse than it is. You're terrified.
Everything.
You're tired.
It's a terrible time to be awake, let alone fighting for your
fighting
very life.
A battle against thousands of orcs and Dunlendings.
That's a good point.
But then in regards to Gandalf's advice, Aragorn says something really wise here. He says, look, let's wait to see the end before we judge. And you know who this reminds me of? It reminds me of Galadriel.
Oh, yeah.
The idea that needless were none of the deeds of Gandalf, you know?
Oh, that is a great catch.
She basically says, don't doubt Gandalf.
Right. And she's saying it to her own husband, who's not quite so sure.
Right.
Yeah. That's a great line and a good catch. For me, it reminded me of Gandalf's own line, but about despair being only for those who see the end beyond all doubt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right. So until we know how this turns out, we can't really judge whether that counsel was wise or not.
Right. No, that's a really good catch.
That's your turn. You had one. I had one.
Exactly. Yeah. No, that's why this is great.
Yeah.
So then Théoden, you know, look, he's like, I know the end is near, basically.
Yeah.
It will not be long. But in a true, absolutely spot-on Circle of Light Beowulf moment.
Yeah.
Théoden says, I refuse to be caught in a trap.
I love that. Like an old badger in a trap. What a line.
Old badger in a trap.
No, he's not going to do that. He's going to have the horn sounded, and he is going to ride forth with his guard.
Yeah.
I love that. The determination. Look, this is going to happen, so I'm going to do it on my terms.
Yeah.
I'm not going to let it happen, you know, where I'm just cowering in a corner someplace. It's not going to be me. And then he asks Aragorn to ride with him. And I love this. He specifically calls him son of Arathorn, which I got to tell you, I think this is a reminder, kind of a little nudge about Aragorn's royal heritage. He is speaking here king to king.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I can get there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think. I mean, I maybe I'm speculating, but.
Well, maybe he's still kind of talking to him as something of an inferior because he calls him son of Arathorn. Right?
That's true. That's true.
He's not a king yet, but he's an heir.
Potential king, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, heir. That's a good way of putting it. Mm-hmm.
I think you're absolutely right. I think he is pointing to his royal heritage.
Yeah.
And I think one of the most important things to notice about this moment is not without hope.
That's right.
You know, Théoden sees two options here. He says, look, maybe we'll cleave a road. Yeah, maybe we'll do it. Maybe we'll get through this thing. Or maybe we'll just make an end that's worth a song if anyone's around to sing about it, which is a little grim.
A little grim.
That is
true,
a bit grim.
But grim, yeah.
But that is like so Beowulfian.
Oh, it is. It really is. Make an end worthy of song. Again, and then the little trailer, if anybody's around to sing it, that is very Beowulfian. Aragorn, of course, is going to ride with him, but I want to discuss the difference here between the text and the film version, because this is one of those things that, because Bernard Hill did such a great job in portraying Théoden, it was so just really strong presence, incredible portrayal, but it's a different character, because in the film, Théoden is far more desperate at this point. He's filled with despair, frankly, at this point in the film.
Yeah.
He has already said the fortress is fallen.
Yeah.
And Aragorn has to remind him, he's the one in the film who says, isn't it said the fortress is not going to fall if men defend it?
That's right. Yeah.
Théoden makes no move to do anything. It's really Aragorn that takes command of this scene. He orders the king's guard to have the civilians make for the mountain road. And then Aragorn in the films is the one who suggests they ride out together. Totally different, takes away from Théoden's strength. And even then, film Théoden is so filled with despair, he's like, oh, for death and glory. And Aragorn reminds him, no, for Rohan, for your people.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is, I think, what's happening here. At that point, Théoden's really just looking to die. And he is hopeless. He doesn't say, maybe we'll cleave a road or make an end worth a song.
Right. He's just like, well, we'll go make an end.
We'll go make an end worth a song. And he does it well. He talks about it well, but it misses that whole idea of the fact that we could cleave a road. There is still hope.
We lose the good option. You know,
that's right.
The possibility of something good happening.
Yeah. So, yeah, once again, book Théoden wins in my book. Sorry. That kind of
Do we need to get you a thesaurus now? You got me one a few episodes ago.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did.
Well, back to the text again. We see here that Aragorn starts going around with Legolas, encouraging the men. More of that great leadership we saw earlier Aragorn and Éomer. But they're also helping in the battle, lending aid wherever the assault's hot.
I still think they're enheartening the men. It just tell me that doesn't sound like embiggens the soul, but
oh, absolutely.
I'm seeing him walk around in this sort of Aragorn, you know, animated with the yellow skin like the Simpsons, walking around, patting him on the back, singing the song. You know, it's Springfield.
That's awful.
So you know, but here we get the blast of fire again, right? Blast of fire leaped up from below, shaking the stones, and we get more grappling hooks and ladders. Again, worth saying that ladder assaults usually fail.
As they do here, right?
Yes. Yeah.
You know, they get to the top and then they're cast down over and over.
And over, right. Which is
again
another
and
difference.
Again.
Yeah.
And again, the defenders cast them down.
And again, yeah.
And again.
And that's another difference because the film shows the enemy taking the outer court of the Hornburg. Remember, they're bashing down the door. That's when Théoden and his guys come rolling out. So.
Right.
But I'm going to have you pick up right there at what I like to call the not parlay parlay.
Now that just makes me think of Captain Barbossa. But.
I know. You know there's going to be a reference to that somewhere in here, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, it has to be.
At last, Aragorn stood above the great gates, heedless of the darts of the enemy. As he looked forth, he saw the eastern sky grow pale. Then he raised his empty hand, palm outward in token of parley. The orcs yelled and jeered.
"Come down! Come down!" they cried. "If you wish to speak to us, come down. Bring out your king. We are the fighting Uruk-hai. We will fetch him from his hole if he does not come. Bring out your skulking king."
"The king stays or comes at his own will," said Aragorn.
"Then what are you doing here?" they answered. "Why do you look out? Do you wish to see the greatness of our army? We are the fighting Uruk-hai."
"I looked out to see the dawn," said Aragorn.
"What of the dawn?" they jeered. "We are the Uruk-hai. We do not stop the fight for night or day, for fair weather or for storm. We come to kill by sun or moon. What of the dawn?"
"None knows what the new day shall bring him," said Aragorn. "Get you gone, ere it turn to your evil."
"Get down, or we will shoot you from the wall," they cried. "This is no parley. You have nothing to say."
"I have still this to say," answered Aragorn. "No enemy has yet taken the Hornburg. Depart, or not one of you will be spared. Not one will be left alive to take back tidings to the north. You do not know your peril." So great a power and royalty was revealed in Aragorn, as he stood there alone above the ruined gates before the host of his enemies, that many of the wild men paused and looked back over their shoulders to the valley, and some looked up doubtfully at the sky. But the orcs laughed with loud voices, and a hail of darts and arrows whistled over the wall as Aragorn leaped down.
Oh, wow. Oh, man. I don't know why I let you take this passage. I love this passage. It's one of my favorite in the whole thing.
Probably because you know how much I love doing orc voices.
Oh, maybe. Maybe that's what it was. No, I think it's because I wanted to do the Cleaver Road, so I knew I had to give you something really, really good.
You chose wisely with that one. But it's so fun to read orc dialogue, though.
It is fun.
It's so fun to inhabit a villain.
It is great. I can't wait to do stuff like the Mouth of Sauron, and, you know, it's going to be fun. That's going to be good stuff. Wait till we do the Nazgul Shrieks. I'm just kidding.
We might need Jordan to help us with those.
I think we might. So Aragorn goes out, I love this, heedless of the orc arrows, and he sees the dawn coming.
That's right. And remember, dawn is ever the hope of men.
Ah, I love that. So he's seeing the hope of men coming. That's really the point.
He's seeing the hope of men. There you go. And then he calls for a parley.
Yeah, he does. And you know what? We should probably clarify what a parley is. It's not just a little chat in the midst of battle. Specifically, a parley is a conference between opposing sides in a dispute, especially a discussion of terms for an armistice, which is a ceasefire or a truce.
Right, exactly. And that's why the orcs start with what they start with, which is basically their first demand, right? Yep. Bring out your king.
Bring out your king.
Bring out your king.
Bring out your king.
Right there. Both right there. I love it.
I know. It's like, oh, man, I'm going to go there. Oh, he's already going there.
Not just your king, though, your skulking king.
Man, I love that line.
They're calling the king a coward, basically, that he's weak. He's afraid to meet them out here in parley. And Aragorn responds, look, the king decides that for himself, you know, which is a subtle reminder that, look, he's still our king.
He's still the king, right?
Yeah.
He gets to decide, not you.
Exactly.
So again, this is supposed to be a parley, which is why the orcs respond basically with, well, then what's your point? And they'll say this again later in even more clearer language.
Right. But they can't pass up the opportunity to brag.
No.
And they brag quite repetitively, I have to point out.
They sure do. Yeah.
It's like, how many times do they have to tell us they're the fighting Uruk-hai?
Yeah. Who are you again?
Right. I kind of wish Aragorn just responds with, like, who are you? The fighting Uruk-hai. The who? I'm sorry. The fighting Uruk-hai. The fighting pool guys? What? Like, I'm sorry. I can't hear you.
I still didn't catch that. Yeah.
It's really loud. I can't hear you.
Can you spell it out for me? Oh, that's
brilliant. You have semaphore flags?
I love it. Oh, the fighting Uruk-hai. Okay,
now
gotcha.
I get it. Okay.
Now I understand.
Sorry.
All right, you're still going to die.
Oh, man.
So, you know, Aragorn, of course, speaks of the dawn. If we're talking about dawn being the hope of men, really what he's saying is, I looked out to see the hope of men.
Yeah, absolutely. That. It's a subtle taunt to the orcs.
It is.
I have to say, they seem to pick up on the taunt. They
do.
They rebut his hope. Like, you know, we don't care about the sun. We're going to keep fighting.
Because we're the Uruk-hai.
Because we're the fighting Uruk-hai. That's right.
And they've got this like motto, right? We do not stop the fight for night or day. It's like a college fight song, you know?
I was thinking like the Postal Service, you know?
Oh, yeah,
rain,
yeah.
Or sleet,
rain or
sleet.
Or yeah, I love that. That's hilarious.
Whatever.
I was thinking of it totally like a college fight song.
Yeah, totally. That would actually be pretty fun.
We come to kill by sun or moon. Yeah.
We come to kill by sun or moon. What of the dawn? What of the dawn? You hear the whole marching band getting in on it.
Like,
you know?
Terrible off key. There's like three notes total.
Yeah.
It's just awful.
But back to the story. Yeah. Aragorn gets bold here. He's like,
oh, he sure does.
And I love, thank you for giving me that line. Cause
yeah,
man, it's like, you don't know what's coming. You are in grave danger here. Leave now while you can.
I love that line. You do not know your peril.
Oh, this is some bravado here.
It really, really is. Now, this is when the orcs make it really clear. This is no parlay. Now, I want to be clear. This doesn't mean they're denying that it was a parlay. They're saying, Aragorn, you're not here to discuss terms of surrender. So get back. This is no longer a parlay.
Because by definition, that is not a parlay.
Right.
You're not here to discuss terms. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. If you were here to discuss terms to say, all right, what do we need to do to end this? Fine. We'll listen to what you have to say.
Which I have to say, am I the only one who's a little shocked or surprised by the fact that orcs might observe a parlay in the first
place?
No,
you're not the only one. Yeah. I assure you of that. I've been trying to figure that out.
Oh, he's coming out for parlay. We have to hang on, guys. Put the bows down.
The bows down. Yeah. Yeah, don't shoot at him. Oh, stop.
I mean,
it.
I guess even orcs have rules, or maybe it's just that they're lazy and they don't want to have to fight if they can get the Rohirrim to surrender.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
Because again, they, you know, their general is terrible and they're going to do the bare minimum necessary to accomplish the task.
Right.
So, I mean, if they get him to bring out Théoden and they surrender, you know, then job done, right? Mission accomplished.
Job done.
That was perfect because that was the orc. No, that wasn't.
No, that was the peasant.
Human, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the human peasant.
Right. Oh, yeah. Oh, man.
I know. I can remember the orc one. That's, I know. I always played as the
Warcraft.
As the guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just, they're orcs. I can't imagine that they care enough about their fellow orcs or the Dunlendings that they want to end the bloodshed. They're not interested in a truce or a ceasefire.
No. I want to go home and see my family, you know? No, they don't care.
No, that's not it. They're here to kill. That's what they do.
By sun or moon, actually, as a matter of fact.
Right.
But yeah, I do think if they're lazy and they think they can accomplish what they want to do with less effort,
they'll take the easy way out for sure. Yeah.
I found it interesting that it's always they cried or they jeered. There clearly isn't a single senior officer orc who was authorized to discuss terms, which honestly, that makes me think they never would have stuck to the terms anyway. Like you said, they're orcs. But if they could have gotten Théoden out and the gate opened, well, then the rest of their job is easier.
Right. And then maybe they kill Théoden, they kill everybody else. But
right.
It's a lot easier that way.
Right. Yeah. Come on out and we'll kill all of you easily. And then we'll kill the rest of you in regular battle.
Right. Because we're orcs.
Right.
And you don't parlay with orcs.
Apparently you do, but only by telling them, get thee gone.
There you go.
Yeah,
you should.
Exactly.
All right. Well, back to the text. Now Aragorn gets really bold. He tells them,
right,
the Hornburg is not taken. The Hornburg has never been taken.
Yeah.
Leave now or none of you will be alive. You have no clue how much danger you're in. Wow.
Leave now or one of us will still be alive.
No, no, that's not it.
All right, all right. So if we stay,
so
then
if we
all
kill
of us
you,
die.
Then all of us die.
No.
No, no, no.
Sorry. My apologies, folks. I do love this moment. No, you're right. Leave now or none of you will be alive. That's a pretty bold threat for a guy behind a busted wall.
Yeah.
Facing an army that's by now 5 to 10 times the size of what he has remaining and saying, you don't know the danger you're in. I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And then we get that moment, the great power and royalty revealed. That reminds me of when Frodo noticed it when he stood up in the boat near the Argonath.
Yeah. Well, when he had that moment where he went into that archaic register and,
oh
yeah,
I love that part of the text. And Frodo just all of a sudden sees him as this kingly guy, this aura of kingliness was revealed. And same thing here. And this had an impact on the Dunlendings, not on the orcs, mind you, they didn't really care, but the Dunlendings, it caused them to pause and to doubt.
Yeah. And I think that's Tolkien showing us the difference between men and orcs, you know?
Even evil men, right. And as we'll see again, even more in next chapter.
Yeah.
There's a really great moment in that. But yeah, the orcs, they don't care. They actually start shooting. Again, this isn't a parlay anymore, so you are a legitimate target. We're going to shoot at you.
Right.
But we'll miss because we're just as bad as stormtroopers.
I was thinking exactly the same thing. Yeah. Now, what do you make of Aragorn saying not one will be left alive?
Oh, man.
I mean, again, is this just pure bravado or does he have something to back this up? Does he know of something to back this up? Does he know what Gandalf's up to right
That's
now?
That's a good question. I mean, I think Aragorn probably knew that Gandalf was maybe rounding up Erkenbrand and his troops. That makes sense. You know, trying to gather forces. I don't know. Could he have even guessed about the Huorns? I don't think so.
I can't imagine he could. I mean, now we have seen him have these moments of a little bit of foresight.
That's possible.
It's possible. I think he just trusts in Gandalf.
I think
he may not
right.
know exactly what Gandalf is up to, but he knows Gandalf is up to something.
Something sufficient to say, look, you do not know the peril you're in. But he's very specific. None of you will be spared. Not one will be left alive.
That is true. And that could be a little bit of foresight.
And that specificity does get carried through. I mean, we'll see it. That's exactly what happens.
It's true.
So maybe this is a little foresight or...
It's a very interesting moment. Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing in the text to make it clear, but I lean towards a combination of foresight and... at least the knowledge that Gandalf is, as you said, doing something.
Doing something.
But yeah. I don't think he knows about the Huorns.
No, I'm sure he doesn't. Well, before we move on, we do want to go back a bit and look at the Dunlendings some more. Because last week, we talked a little bit about where they came from, right? We talked about their heritage as kin of the folk of Haleth. We talked a little bit about how their grievances with Rohan dated back to their enmity with Numenor in the Second Age.
Yeah, that's right.
In the War of the Ring... Aragorn is actually having this parley with the captain of the Westfold, which is the leader of the Dunlendings.
Okay. When it would be a proper parley, yeah.
Right, exactly, because it's man to man. Yeah. And the Dunlending says that if you give up the king, all may go alive to Isengard, and the Westmarch would be given back to the Dunlendings.
That's right. But then in the text of this draft, Tolkien says, Aragorn rebukes Westfolder for aiding orcs. Westfolder is humbled. Orc captain jeers. Needs must accept the terms when no others will serve. We are the Uruk-hai, we slay.
Even in the early draft, they had to make sure to name drop themselves.
That's right. They're talking about themselves in the third person all the time. The Uruk-hai. Yeah. Orcs shoot an arrow at Aragorn as they retreat, but the Westfold captain hews down the archer. That's right. In the draft, they have the leader of the Dunlendings kill an orc for violating the terms of a parley. And quite possibly because he's also been humbled by Aragorn, pointing out their alliance with orcs, but we don't know for sure.
Wow. So the leader of the Dunlendings in that early draft had more honor than Aragorn in the movie when he hews off the head of the mouth of Sauron. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't do that in a parlay. No.
Sorry. Don't mean to bash that, but.
Well, we'll bash it again when we get to that chapter, I'm certain.
We will.
Yeah. That's one of my gripes.
I did not like that moment.
No.
Well, back to the text again. I feel like I'm the one saying that over and over this episode.
It's because maybe I've been digressing more often. I don't know.
Maybe so. But we get another explosion, and the gate has just been crumbled by a blast.
Oh, yeah.
Aragorn runs to the King's Tower, but to get ready to ride.
Right. I mean, the text doesn't say that, but it's exactly what we know he is doing. And now with the gate fallen and the orcs ready to take the fortress, this is when they actually waver. This is their moment, but... there's a concern. They get this murmur like a wind in the distance.
Mm-hmm. And the sounds of dismay cause them to look back.
That's right.
But that's not all, because now they're hearing something else. They're hearing the great horn of Helm.
Yes.
Ringing out. And that is where you're going to pick up.
Yes, I will. All that heard that sound trembled. Many of the orcs cast themselves on their faces and covered their ears with their claws. Back from the deep, the echoes came. Blast upon blast, as if on every cliff and hill a mighty herald stood. But on the walls men looked up, listening with wonder, for the echoes did not die. Ever the horn blasts wound on among the hills. Nearer now and louder they answered one to another, blowing fierce and free. "Helm! Helm!" the riders shouted. "Helm is arisen and comes back to war! Helm for Theoden King!" And with that shout, the king came. His horse was white as snow. Golden was his shield, and his spear was long. At his right hand was Aragorn, Elendil's heir. Behind him rode the lords of the House of Aorl the Young. Light sprang in the sky. Night departed. "Forth, Eolingus!" With a cry and a great noise, they charged. Down from the gates they roared. Over the causeway they swept,
and they drove through the hosts of Isengard as a wind among grass. Behind them, from the deep, came the stern cries of men issuing from the caves, driving forth the enemy. Out poured all the men that were left upon the rock, and ever the sound of blowing horns echoed in the hills.
Oh, man. Well, Aragorn's power and royalty might not have impacted the orcs, but this sure has.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, hearing the horn, some cast themselves on their faces and they cover their ears.
I love the touch with their claws, by the way, with their hands.
Yeah.
And then the blasts just keep coming. They don't fade. They wind on nearer and louder. Oh.
Well, remember, we were told a few pages ago, and I think we talked about this two episodes ago.
Yeah, I think
so. A trumpet sounded upon the tower, echoed in the deep behind, as if armies long forgotten were issuing to war from caves beneath the hills.
That is a great quote.
Yeah, and that's exactly what's going on. We see that here.
Absolutely, that's exactly what's going on. And in this case, fortunately, a not long forgotten, less than an army, but still men are going to come from the caves, as we'll see.
Right.
But the men, in the meantime, believe that the legend himself, Helm Hammerhand, has come back and is going to war for Theoden.
Right. And then Theoden himself rides out.
He does. And man, I'm sorry, look at that language. His horse was white as snow. Golden was his shield and his spear was long. Oh, I love that. This is more of that archaism, but it works so well.
It is. And it's just, it's epic. It's got this epic weight to it, you know? And then just some of the terminology that's used here. You know, we get Aragorn, a moment ago, he was son of Arathorn.
Right.
Theoden addressed him. Now he's Elendil's heir.
Yes. That's so central right there. I mean, this is all about his kingship too, isn't
it? This is all about his kingship and going all the way back to his legendary ancestor.
Yeah.
You know, this is really pointing out the epic lineage of Aragorn, more so than son of Arathorn. He's heir of Elendil, king to be of Gondor, and he's riding on Theoden's right hand.
Yes, he is.
And we've got the lords of Theoden's house coming right behind. But again, not just the lords of Theoden's house, the lords of the house of Erol the Young.
Yes.
Again, we're harking back to those ancient legendary heroes that these guys are descended from.
That's right. I mean, we just talked about Helm Hammerhand, you know, coming back, obviously not actually coming back, but you know, you've got the recollection of Helm, and now we've got the recollection all the way back to Elendil, and now even all the way back to the founding of Rohan, you know, when they came down to Calanarthon, and you've got the House of Eorl the Young.
Right.
Oh, great stuff. And then we get this amazing pair of lines, light sprang in the sky, night departed. This is dawn coming and the night going away. This is Aure and Tuliva.
Day has come again. Absolutely.
Day has come. And then, fourth Eorlingus. They charge down the causeway as a wind among grass. Oh, such visuals here.
Yeah. And then at the same time, we've got men coming from the caves and from the fortress.
Yeah.
Thanks to the signaling of the horn, right?
That's right. They couldn't coordinate a united effort in any other way. You know, they didn't have radios or cell phones or anything. So the horn is the signal. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And now they ride victorious, and neither orc nor man, even the captains and the champions, fell or fled. None can stand before them.
None shall pass.
That doesn't diminish the moment at all. Thank you.
Not at all. Not at all. No, you're right. I mean, their backs are to the riders. That's what the text tells us. Basically, they're already being routed.
Yeah.
One attack.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, we mentioned just a moment ago the fact that the horn is a signal, right?
Yes. Yes.
Brett Devereaux actually makes this point clear, and he also has some other really interesting things to say about this charge.
Yeah.
He says, the horn serves two purposes here. First, it momentarily panics the orcs, providing an opening for Theoden's charge. Second, it's a clever bit of signal work. Theoden is not going to cut his way through the entire orc army. The numerical disparity is too great. But a series of sudden shocks, delivered close together, might rout the army. That means he needs to coordinate his blows so that the shocks come fast enough that the orcs have no time to regroup and regain composure. The horn provides a way of signaling Éomer, who with Gimli and a good amount of the Rohirrim is holed up in the caves, to also attack at the same time. That in turn also means that when Theoden reaches the bottom of the causeway, there's a good chance Éomer's force will be close behind, making it less likely that the king will be cut off.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And Brett goes on, though, to compare this to the film version, where Theoden, Aragorn, and the riders somehow manage to trample all those orcs that are equipped with pikes.
On the causeway, right. Now, he says that unlike that version, here we have an explanation for why the orcs collapse before the charge. They are already worried by word that an enemy has shown up behind them when the horn blast and then the shock of the charge itself sends them to flight. They are, in fact, casting themselves to the ground before Theoden begins his attack. Consequently, Theoden isn't charging head-on into a solid mass of orcs, but rather pursuing a retreating body of orcs down the causeway. Very different.
Very different indeed. And again, I think it just goes back to Peter Jackson knows the language of film. He knows what's going to look cool.
Oh, yeah. That aerial shot of the horses going down the causeway, really cool.
Oh, it's fantastic. And it's a very emotional moment as a viewer. Oh, you're like, oh, this is great. But, you know, Tolkien has a bit more knowledge of the way medieval warfare was actually waged.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously Brett Devereaux does, too.
I'm also, by the way, I know this isn't even in our notes, but I'm a little bugged by the fact that they have Gimli blowing the horn, who has no history with the Rohirrim. This is the horn of Helm.
That was a weird moment. That was a weird moment.
Can we get a Rohirrim guy to do this, please?
That was a weird moment. I mean, I know why they did it. They did it because, A, they want Gimli to do a heroic thing because he's kind of just been comic relief for the most part.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And secondly, like, you don't want to introduce another guy. Like, who's this random guy blowing this awesome horn, you know?
Yeah. I would have liked it to have been Hama, but they'd already had him killed by the wargs, which...
They had, that's right.
Come on! Anyway.
Yeah.
Well, let me have you pick up right there as the king rides down from the gate. I can't wait to start talking about what we see here in the Deeping Coombe. Oh, boy. Yeah. Change of story now.
Yeah. So just a short reading here, and then we'll talk a little bit, and then we'll move on.
All right, then.
So King Theoden rode from Helm's Gate and clove his path to the great dike. There the company halted. Light grew bright about them. Shafts of the sun flared above the eastern hills and glimmered on their spears, but they sat silent on their horses, and they gazed down upon the Deeping Coombe. The land had changed. Where before the green dale had lain, its grassy slopes lapping the ever-mounting hills, there now a forest loomed. Great trees, bare and silent, stood, rank on rank, with tangled bough and hoary head. Their twisted roots were buried in the long green grass. Darkness was under them. Between the dike and the eaves of that nameless wood, only two open furlongs lay. There now cowered the proud hosts of Saruman, in terror of the king and in terror of the trees. They streamed down from Helm's Gate until all above the dike was empty of them, but below it they were packed like swarming flies. Vainly they crawled and clambered about the walls of the coombe, seeking to escape. Upon the east, too sheer and stony was the valley's side. Upon the left, from the west, their final doom approached.
The final doom.
It's the final doom now.
All right. So Theoden not only rides from the gate, but manages to cleave that road, doesn't he? All the way down to the dike. I love that. And then we see this moment of light and sun shafts. Now, they pause, not for an Instagram photo op, but because of what they see in the coombe below.
And also, why not just get a quick selfie.
Right, exactly. Why not? I mean, they've got, thousands of followers, so.
Yeah. Hashtag no filter. Hashtag day comes again. And this is absolutely fantastic. I mean, the light, of course, is both their literal hope, and it's also symbolic of hope. But
that's
then
right.
We see that the land has changed. A forest looms on the slopes.
Yeah.
A forest that looks like it's been around a while, right? These are great trees. They have tangled boughs, hoary heads, twisted roots, darkness beneath them. These are the marks of a very old forest.
Right, right. That's the thing. You know, these aren't young trees that are just look like they've just grown there. Right.
Right. And then it's called this nameless wood, which, okay, obviously, it wasn't there before. So
you don't name things that aren't there. It's true.
Right. But that fact that it's nameless underscores the mysteriousness of it.
True. That makes sense. Now, location-wise, it's only a quarter mile below the dike. So it is as far below the dike as the dike is below the gate. The dike is literally the halfway mark between the gate and the new forest, just to kind of give you some pictures.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And now Saruman's army is stuck there. And I love this. They're in terror of the king and of the trees.
Oh, there's a bad place to be now.
Oh, yeah. There's nowhere for them to go. I mean, they can't go back towards the gate. To the east, it's too sheer. And then from the west, their final doom approached.
Doom, doom, doom.
And now we need to see what that is.
I shall read their final doom. There, suddenly upon a ridge, appeared a rider, clad in white, shining in the rising sun.
Over the low hills, the horns were sounding. Behind him, hastening down the long slopes, were 1,000 men on foot. Their swords were in their hands. Amid them strode a man tall and strong. His shield was red. As he came to the valley's brink, he set to his lips a great black horn and blew a ringing blast. "Erkenbrand!" the riders shouted. "Erkenbrand!"
"Behold the White Rider!" cried Aragorn. "Gandalf has come again!"
"Mithrandir! Mithrandir!" said Legolas.
"This is wizardry indeed! Come, I would look on this forest ere the spell changes."
The hosts of Isengard roared, swaying this way and that, turning from fear to fear. Again the horn sounded from the tower. Down through the breach of the dike charged the king's company. Down from the hills leaped Erkenbrand, lord of Westfold. Down leaped Shadowfax, like a deer that runs sure-footed in the mountains. The White Rider was upon them, and the terror of his coming filled the enemy with madness. The wild men fell on their faces before him. The orcs reeled and screamed and cast aside both sword and spear. Like a black smoke driven by a mounting wind, they fled. Wailing, they passed under the waiting shadow of the trees, and from that shadow, none ever came again.
Whoa!
Man. Wow.
Oh!
All right. End of the chapter, so let's talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
We see the doom, right? We see Gandalf on the ridge, shining in the sunrise. Doom for them. Good for us.
That's right. And now the horns are sounding again, and you get this 1,000-strong infantry, all ready for battle. Their swords are already drawn, and they're led by a man tall and strong. I love this description. It's all we get of him, with a red shield and a black horn.
Mm-hmm. Infantry reinforcements, not cavalry reinforcements like we are used to seeing in the movie.
Well, not alone cavalry reinforcements that have to navigate a 50-degree slope filled with gravel into a wall of pikes that's already been formed.
And I remember that from a collection of unmitigated pedantry.
Yeah, I remember it from watching the movie thinking, this is not possible.
Well, yeah, but I remember like reading just like how...
Oh, I know. He ripped that to shreds.
He did. He did.
And he's absolutely right. Half those horses would have fallen down and the other half of riders would have all died behind them.
And now we're sad.
In a big tumble of horse flesh that would have just run into the wall of orc pipes.
And everyone leaves the theater crying.
Yeah. Movie over, man.
But no, in the book, this is Erkenbrand and Gandalf who come with this infantry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, do you think this is a Eucatastrophe? I want us to talk about this a little bit. I think it might be, but I'm not sure if it's like a by-the-book Eucatastrophe.
That's the thing. I don't know. You know how the whole point about a Eucatastrophe is that you can't count on them ever to happen again. And I'm not saying you could count on this every time, but Aragorn was literally counting on this.
That is true.
He made his decisions based on the fact that Gandalf said I'd be back. And Gandalf will even point out later, I said I would be coming, so why is this a surprise?
That is true.
The Huorns are definitely a catastrophe, though.
The Huorns are certainly a catastrophe, and this is certainly a fleeting glimpse of joy.
Oh, yes. You know,
this is a sudden, joyous turn. But I think you're right, because it can be counted on.
Yeah.
And like you said, Aragorn is counting on it. I don't think it's a by-the-book catastrophe.
Yeah, we get the first half, that poignant joy that almost brings you to tears.
Yeah.
But the part about it not being able to be counted on, it may be disqualified on that count.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it has moments. It has eucatastrophic elements, but it's definitely not by the book.
Yeah, you're right. No, it has eucatastrophic sensation
aspects
to it.
Yeah, it feels eucatastrophic.
It just doesn't quite meet the full definition.
Right.
I think. But
yeah. But the Huorns certainly do.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. And folks, if you have a different take on that, please let us know. We'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. This is not meant to be the absolute answer to the question. It's just something we thought would be fun to talk
about. We're 209 episodes through. This is not the answer to the question, in case you're wondering.
We do not give absolute answers to questions.
No, we do not.
But the Huorns are certainly a Eucatastrophe, and Legolas recognizes that this mysterious forest is wizardry.
Yeah.
And of course, he wants to check it out.
Like right now. I mean, he's like, I know the battle's still wrapping up, but I want to go check out this forest.
Yeah.
He's very distracted.
Dude, come on.
Yeah. I mean, the war is still happening because now the king's company comes to the dike. The horn blows again. So you've got Theoden and his guys, cavalry force coming, small. And then you've got this huge 1,000-strong infantry coming from the west.
Yeah.
Things are getting bad if you're an orc or a Dunlending, aren't you?
Quite. And we see them filled with madness.
Oh, yeah.
But we're getting two slightly different responses depending on orcs versus Dunlendings. The Dunlendings fall on their faces before Gandalf.
Uh-huh.
The orcs, though, they drop their weapons and run, heading for the trees.
I'm out of here. Yeah.
Not a good choice, as we'll see.
No, no, because as Aragorn said earlier, not one will be left alive.
Right.
Yeah, maybe. Well, no, even if you'd stuck around, you would have been killed.
Yeah.
We'll take Dunlending prisoners, not orc prisoners, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, not one will be left alive.
And thus, the good guys win.
Yeah. Yay.
But we're not quite done with the chapter or this discussion.
No.
I think a little after-action report from Devereaux is in order.
I think so, yeah.
Going back just a bit, he says, even before Erkenbrand arrives, or the Huorns have killed a single orc, there cowered the proud hosts of Saruman, in terror of the king and in terror of the trees. Vainly they crawled and clambered about the walls of the Coombe, seeking to escape. Back to Devereaux's words, the army has been done in not by a flanking maneuver, not by the might of the trees, but by the collapse of morale and cohesion brought on by the appearance of a new force, which has not yet attacked, and the dismay at the horn sounding and Theoden's charge. It is only then that Erkenbrand's force, infantry, not cavalry, arrives and, moving down the slope, ends the battle by shoving the collapsing orcs into the trees where they are destroyed.
Yeah, and Brett goes on to discuss that morale and cohesion issue a bit more, and he catches something that we've pointed out a few times, that while the Rohirrim are driven back, they regroup and push back. As he says, the Rohirrim cohere. They stick tightly together rather than scatter, which is what enables their recovery time after time. Now, on the other hand, Saruman's army falls apart, Devereaux pointing out that Saruman's army looks formidable. It is large. The Uruks are well-armed and very confident. The weakness isn't in their weapons, but in their minds. I don't mean that they are stupid, Brett says. Rather, the Uruks aren't motivated towards strong group loyalty, or much regard for their masters, or even a strong sense of themselves as professionals who don't run away. Each orc schemes for his own advantage at the expense of all the others, and frequently his master besides. That principle, mutual gain in victory, the promise of loot, I can get an army to the battlefield, but it cannot sustain it there when things start to go wrong, and things always go wrong in war.
Then he goes back to the chapter The Uruk-hai and points out that Ugluk's leadership, and I'm making air quotes when I say that, is pathetic.
Oh, it is.
He kills his men at a time when they need every good fighter, and he shifts blame, like to Snaga and the Mordor orcs.
Right.
Now reading from Brett's blog, with such a lackluster officer class, it's not hard to see why this army falls apart. No help comes from the top, as Saruman sends his army out to fight and die while he hides in his tower. A savvier leader ought to have known that an army this green and this weakly organized would need to have its charismatic leader with it to function effectively. It's no surprise that Saruman's army mirrors his own cowardice.
Ooh, great line.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, contrary to that, he explains that the Rohirrim, bound by strong sets of vertical and horizontal social ties, that is, ties between leaders and followers, and ties between equals, regroup around their leaders, recover, and push back again.
Boy, that is a big difference. And you're right, that's how they're able to do it. And while I don't want this to turn into the Brett Devereaux, except he's not here podcast, which is rapidly in danger of becoming, I think there's one last paragraph I want us to read that really ties this into the why for Tolkien. He starts by pointing out that it isn't their superiority on the battlefield that enables the Rohirrim to win the day. It is their will to resist. Devereaux points out that this, quote, fits into the metaphysics of Tolkien's broader world-building effort, which I think are often badly misunderstood by readers and viewers alike. I have encountered this assumption that Tolkien's world is one in which the good guys win because that is how the story is structured or because they get lucky, but that's not quite right. Middle-earth is a world animated by spiritual forces that exist beyond the physical world but are no less real than it. In essence, Tolkien's world is one where Virgil's line, posunt quia posse videntur, which means they are able because they think themselves able, is an actual physical law. The hero's triumph is a direct supernatural result of their resolve to resist evil. Now, I think he's right, and I think this also ties into Gandalf's whole purpose, right? The Astari, the original purpose, was to encourage the free peoples to resist Sauron, and that resistance enables their victory.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Man.
100%.
Great stuff. Well, now, Tolkien doesn't mention this. You know, he talks about Eric and Brand and Gandalf. He doesn't mention that it wasn't just the two of them. It was Barlaman with his mailbag in tow, and anyone would quail at the sight of such a mighty weapon.
It is heavy enough to knock out an Uruk. That is true.
So let's take a look at that. And after we're done, well, the talk still continues all night long at the Prancing Pony.
It certainly does. Our fantastic listener community keeps the conversation going in all of our social media spaces. At our Common Room on Facebook, you'll find comments, questions, corrections, and more on every episode, as well as updates from us throughout the week. Just look for the Prancing Pony Podcast on Facebook.
And be sure to follow the page and join the group that we created earlier this season. The page lets us keep you up to date on the latest PPP happenings, like the moot that's ending today. But the group gives you a great chance to discuss Tolkien with your fellow listeners.
And of course, we also have some really good discussions going on over on Reddit. You can find us there at r/PrancingPonyPod. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, both with the handle @PrancingPonyPod.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're enjoying the show, please share us. And please consider giving us a review on Apple Podcasts.
Now, if you want exclusive content, postscripts, full bonus episodes, live Discord events with Sean and me, and episodes without the digital ads, then check out patreon.com/PrancingPonyPod, where you can support the show by joining the fellowship of the podcast. Now, let's go ahead and see what messages Barlaman has brought us. Sean?
Well, we just made it through the whole Battle of Helm's Deep, and Legolas didn't even surf on one shield down one flight of steps. So, because of that, why don't we go ahead and answer this question from Kevin D.
All right.
In a previous episode, he says, we jokingly said Legolas is always defying the laws of physics. On Caradhras in the snowstorm, he says, for running light over grass and leaf or over snow, an elf. It seems to me, Kevin says, that even the most rustic of elves, which Legolas is not, has some ability to do things that even the lightest of hobbits can't.
Hmm.
It seems that some limited control over nature is innate in elves, even the ones that are Ivari. How do you think he does this?
Hmm.
Alan, what say you?
Well, I certainly don't think he defies the laws of physics regarding the curvature of the earth and his eyesight, as I pointed out a dozen times, but
I don't know. He sure seems to. The proof is in the text for that.
Let's go back to the moment Kevin's referencing. Aragorn and Boromir have started digging a path back to safety through the snow on Caradhras. And then Legolas watched them for a while with a smile upon his lips. You look pretty cocky there, Legolas. And then he turned to the others. The strongest must seek a way, say you. But I say, let a plowman plow. But choose an otter for swimming, and for running light over grass and leaf, or over snow, an elf. With that, he sprang forth nimbly, and then Frodo noticed, as if for the first time, though he had long known it, that the elf had no boots, but wore only light shoes, as he always did, and his feet made little imprint in the snow. All right, but I admit that doesn't get us any closer to an answer for Kevin.
No, I am no lighter running on snow, whether I'm barefoot or not, so
no.
I don't think Legolas is either.
No.
Now, we do have another reading that's kind of similar that might help us a little bit here. Back in Lothlorien, Haldir, who did not die in this episode.
No Haldirs were harmed in the making of this episode.
Yep. Haldir explains that they don't make bridges across Celebrant. Instead, he made his end of the rope fast about another tree and then ran lightly along it, over the river and back again, as if he were on a road. I can walk this path, said Legolas, but the others have not this skill.
Hmm.
Now, some similar word choices there. Running light versus ran lightly. But there's a twist here. In the Lothlorien bit, Legolas points out that this is a skill.
Ah.
And maybe, I'm speculating here, but maybe it's a skill that's developed in Northern Mirkwood and maybe other Sylvan realms too.
Sure.
And so elves of these regions have the ability to run light over grass and leaf.
Mm.
So one might take that to mean it's something they've learned as opposed to being something that's totally innate.
That's not unreasonable. I mean, I can buy that it's a skill of some kind developed over the hundreds of years of an elvish lifespan, but I still would have to think there's got to be something about the very nature of elves that makes it easier for them to gain this skill.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine dwarves, even working on this for 200 years, learning how to run
light.
Are
going to learn it the way elves can. Yeah.
Right. And part of it is their physical nature. I mean, elves are described as tall, as lithe, as agile, and I think that's our start. But I have to wonder, and this is kind of grasping at straws here, but I wonder if it's something to do with the fact that they're fading. Maybe it's more of a literal fade than is apparent? almost like a reduction in mass, like they're more Fea than Hroa by this point. I don't know, but I think there may be a bit of all of this here.
That's interesting. I hadn't considered the fading as a factor. I mean, Tolkien does describe it as a literal consumption of the Hroa by the Fea. Yeah,
eventually, so, to the point that elves don't have bodies anymore. That's why we don't see them anymore.
Right, exactly. So at some point, yeah, they would have virtually no mass because they would be all Fea by that point. Mm. I don't know if it's that advanced by this point.
No.
But maybe there's something to that. Maybe because it's in progress, maybe they're lighter. That's a possibility. Maybe. I'm not totally sure. I don't think it's like a magical control over nature of a really, I don't know, of a really overt way.
Right.
I do think that maybe, like Magia, there is probably something in elves that makes this a skill that they can learn while others can't. Kind of like you were saying a moment ago.
Yeah.
I'm remembering Tolkien's words in letter number 131.
Drink.
Good call.
Letter 131.
Yeah. In that letter, Tolkien talks about how the elves' magic is art. Delivered from many of its human limitations. More effortless, more quick, more complete.
Ah.
Now, of course, he's talking about artistic skill there. He's not talking about feats of strength and dexterity, but still, I think that supports the idea that elves have a closeness to the material of Arda, including the material that's in their own bodies, right? All the atoms of Arda, even the stuff that they're made of, that makes these sorts of natural skills easier for them.
Makes sense.
We certainly know they master their own bodies better than other people's. We know they can go without food or sleep for long periods of time. And so that suggests a control over their bodies.
I think so.
I don't know. I don't know that we've landed anywhere exactly, but
no.
I kind of like all of the above for this one.
Yeah, I think so too. A little bit of each, yeah.
Yeah. So that works for me. Hope you like that one, Kevin.
Fair enough.
Alan, do we have time for one more?
I think we do. Just a couple of episodes back, we had a really fun question about the things that didn't make it into the official legendarium that we would have liked to see. Well, Josh M. in Lynchburg, Virginia writes in asking a slightly tougher one. If you could change one thing in the canon of Tolkien's legendarium and one thing in the movie adaptations, what would they be? Oh, boy.
One thing in each?
Yeah. Yeah.
Man.
Hmm.
All right, well, I assume we're talking about the movie adaptations of The Lord of the Rings here, because my list for The Hobbit would be very
goodness,
long.
Yeah, no. The one thing I would change in that adaptation is that it doesn't exist. That would be better. Yeah.
Yeah. If we're just talking about Lord of the Rings, there's still a few things I could point to, but if I had to choose one, I don't think I'm going to surprise anybody with this. It would be Eowyn's character arc.
Okay, that's absolutely surprises no one.
I know.
Unless you're going to complain about the absence of Eärendil.
which I might do at another time.
Yeah.
No, look, I appreciate what they tried to do with Eowyn by giving her more time in the movies, but the way they developed her, I just don't think it quite worked. I mean, not only did they add way too many scenes of her just pining over Aragorn, which I talked all about in episode 50, but they just robbed her of all of her best moments. I mean, I know it's hard to hide Miranda Otto under a helmet in a movie and make you think that it's a man.
Yeah.
But still, knowing that it was Eowyn instead of Durnhelm under there made the reveal just so much less powerful.
Oh, it did. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah. Not to mention her great speech before the Witch King was reduced to one line, which of course has made it into the popular consciousness as the way that scene plays out, which is frustrating.
It is.
And then, of course, in the theatrical version, you never see her again after that moment until there's like one shot at the very end where she makes eyes at Faramir. And that's supposed to be, you know, how we see that they're going to have a relationship. Look, I loved Return of the King overall.
Yeah.
But that movie especially, I walked out of that theater disappointed because of the changes to Eowyn.
That's fair. That's totally fair. And, you know, as much as I enjoy the Lord of the Rings films, I think I'm going to surprise nobody here as well. I changed what they did to Faramir. Right.
Shocking as many people shocking, as we're shocked,
shocked
by
I tell
me changing
you.
Eowyn's arc. I know.
You know, you wanted to hear Eowyn give her speech, right, on the Pelennor Fields.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to hear Faramir say, I would not take this thing if it lay by the highway. Not when Minas Tirith falling in ruin and I alone could save her so, using the weapon of the Dark Lord for her good and my glory. I wanted to hear that line. It's one of my favorite lines in the whole text.
Totally.
So I was gutted when movie Faramir said, a chance for Faramir, captain of Gondor, to show his quality, followed by, the ring will go to Gondor. I'm pretty sure I shrieked in disappointment.
With good reason.
Just
good reason.
No, what did you do to my favorite character?
Again, exactly my thing as I walked out of Return of the King.
I mean, and I get it. I get it from the cinematic standpoint. I know the whole
character's
got to have an arc, etc. I totally get it. And Faramir in the books is noble from the get-go. And you got to have him grow in a cinematic tale, but
And look, I know it seems like we've bashed the movies a lot in this episode, like we haven't in a long time.
Yeah, these three.
You know what I think is frustrating about these moments, though? Like you're talking about Faramir and I'm talking about Eowyn. It's the fact that these things have a way of becoming part of the conversation about the story.
People start to get things confused. They remember the films because films are so memorable.
Right. And so even now you have people in Tolkien fan circles, people who read the books like we do, saying things like, "I am no man." That is not the line in the book.
It's not.
Eowyn does not say that in the book.
No, she does not.
So it's things like that. And so you start to see the characters in a certain way. You start to hear the characters saying certain things that are not what they say in the book.
Yeah.
And I just think it's frustrating for those of us who are fans of the books. It's not like we're trying to bash it. It's not that we're trying to be purists. It's just that it changes the perception of the story and it changes the perception of these characters. And I think for those of us who have an attachment to these characters, like you and I do to Faramir and Eowyn, it hurts a little bit. I'm sorry, it just does.
You're right. I mean, it is kind of a sad way to put it. It hurts.
It just hurts, it does. Man.
I mean, I really did feel this pain in my gut when Faramir said the ring would go to Gondor for the first time.
Yeah.
I mean, I would just, no, that's not what he's supposed to say.
And I remember telling my wife for like a year who hadn't read the books at that time, telling her for a year after Two Towers, like, "Oh, watch Eowyn. She's amazing. Just watch. She's going to, like, I didn't want to spoil anything, but I'm like, just watch. She's the character to watch in the next movie." And then like we walked out, I was just like, "Oh, okay. Well, all the stuff that I thought was going to happen didn't happen."
Oh, I know. Yeah.
So
What about the books? What about the books?
Okay. Yeah. Let's get back on track here because we're digressing a bit. So as for the books, I probably would change more things about the first age and the way it played out. Like have Tolkien finish the Silmarillion the way he wanted to, more Arendelle and stuff like that, obviously. But if we're talking about Lord of the Rings, which I think is what we're supposed to be talking about here, I don't know that I would change anything in the canon exactly. One thing I would have loved to have seen in the book would be Sauron actually making an appearance.
Ooh, yeah.
You know, and I understand. I think Tolkien was intentionally making him this faceless presence of evil, but in doing that, it's kind of left readers scratching their heads a little bit about his corporeality. You know, there's the whole, like, is he really just a flaming eye? Is he really a spirit? Or does he actually have nine fingers, like it actually says he does in the book? You know,
right.
There's a lot of confusion about that. And I'm not saying I want, like, a whole series of chapters from his point of view, like Game of Thrones or anything.
Dear Diary.
That would be interesting.
That would be great.
And I certainly don't want him to actually stroll out of the Black Gate like Peter Jackson almost had him do if you watch the appendices.
Oh, I'm so glad that did not make the final cut. Yeah.
So I get that it's a tough problem to solve. How do you make him appear without kind of breaking the frame narrative and everything? But I do wish that we had gotten more because, you know, the book is named after him. And it would have been nice to see him.
The Lord of the Rings. The who now?
Right.
Well, when it comes to the books for me, I got to say this is really, really a hard question. I don't think there's anything I would change. That is, I wouldn't remove anything or switch it up like, say, I don't know, bringing the elves to Helm's Deep.
Hey.
Sorry. It's more like what would I add to make it more complete, right? For me, in that sense, I would love to spend more time in Gondor after the start of the Fourth Age. I want to have an epilogue to see how Aragorn settles in as king and begins to rebuild. Maybe spend a little time with Faramir and Eowyn and Ithilien. That's what I think.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, even seeing him develop that epilogue of Sam and his kids.
Yeah.
That we get in Sauron Defeated. Even that would have been cool.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, look, Well, I'm Back is about as perfect an ending as you can get.
Oh, it really is.
An epilogue would have been cool.
It is. It is the perfect Anglo-Saxon ending. I know we're going to talk more about that, including some very choice Tom Shippey quotes when we get there in a little over 3 years.
Yeah.
Still 3 years. Well, folks, that wraps it up for another episode of the Prancing Pony Podcast. But be sure to join us again next week when you get to hear a little bit of the PPP Digital Moot.
And join us again in 2 weeks for a walk along the road to Isengard. And that's going to be just as fun as it sounds.
But does it sound fun, Sean? I mean, really?
No, it doesn't. That's the point.
No.
Come on. We're going on the road to Isengard. Like, no.
We're doing
No.
Yeah, no, I'm good. I'm good.
You guys
man.
Go
Enjoy.
Without me. I'm cool. I'll catch up later.
Text me when you get there. Send me a picture.
Right. Seriously, though, as always, we want to take a moment to thank some truly important people. That's our patrons at the Cured Ends contribution tier. I'll start the list with DeMay in Alaska, James in Virginia, Tamsin in Minnesota, Chad in Texas, Lance in New Jersey, Paul in Colorado, Jerry in Texas, Bruce in California, Mario in Utah, Seth in Texas, Ella in California, and Joseph in Texas.
Then we have Kathy from North Carolina, Lori from Washington, Josh in Oklahoma, Carlos in California, Brian from the UK, Cameron in Nevada, Ned from Connecticut, Jerry from Washington, and Nick from Wisconsin. Now, thank you all so much for your support. We also want to thank the team that helps make the show better. Our research assistants, including Marilyn R. Pakila, as well as our barlaman, Becca Davis, producer Jordan Runnels, social media manager Casey Hilsey, event and Patreon community coordinator Katie McKenna, and website guru Phil Dean.
This show truly would not be what it is without our supporters and our teammates, so thank you all.
Absolutely.
Now be sure you don't miss any episodes of the Prancing Pony Podcast. Subscribe to the show through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.
And one last thing, as always, don't forget to send your thoughts, comments, and most of all, your best parlay stories to Barlaman@theprancingponypodcast.com.
Barlaman's gotten a lot more reliable these days, but we do get a lot of mail. So we'll get to you as soon as we can, and your question or comment may be featured on a future episode.
As always, this has been far too short a time to spend among such excellent and admirable listeners. But until next time,
farewell, friends.